From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Renata Adler made her name early as a young New Yorker writer in the 1960s, covering Selma, Vietnam, the Six-Day War, the hippies. She did a blazing stint as film critic for the New York Times, was in the middle of Watergate, wrote two novels recently re-released. Her writing is fierce, sharp, clear-eyed, in some quarters feared, and she's still watching. This hour on Point, Renata Adler, on American culture now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you want to know about where we are, where we're headed, from a top, sharp writer who's watched for so long? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Renata Adler joins me from New York. Her most recent book is a collection of her nonfiction titled After the Tall Timber. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Renata Adler, welcome to On Point.
Well, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming in and sitting down with us. We wanted to talk with you for a long time, and suddenly the time has just come around. Are you writing these days?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I am. I mean, to the degree I ever do, yes.
What's got
yes.
your attention? What are you focused on?
Well, you know, it varies quite a lot. I think I finished a novel some time ago, and it's time I handed it in, so I work at that a little bit. And then I'm trying to work on another piece, a nonfiction piece. But what I've been thinking about a lot, just as it sounds more abstract than it mm-hmm. actually is, mm-hmm. is the question of memory. Because, well, I mean, do you want me to say more about that?
Or yes, please. Yes, please. I want to go where you want to go, and memory is a good one.
Well, I'm not so sure where to go here. It begins for me with the question of what do we know by heart? And it's a kind of, even that phrase is a little bit dated, although the word memorize is mm-hmm. awful, always was awful. Commit to memory is not so bad. But when we went to school, and perhaps all the generations before us who had the opportunity to go to school, children love to learn things by heart.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know that. And they, you know, if you read something at bedtime, they'll learn it by heart and so forth. So they love to commit things to memory. So it used to be that all of us had to read certain poems. And depending on whatever school you went to, they were either terrible poems or they were really mm-hmm. great poems. And maybe they were right for age. Maybe they were not. But I don't even mean poetry exactly. I mean all the things that we remember in common, including commercials that were awful or mm-hmm. pop songs that we loved or pop songs we wish would stop going through our heads. And so
plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. And all that.
Well, that's it. That's for it for a commercial. But, I mean, mm-hmm. if there's a song that you can't, you know, which mm-hmm. has happened to all of us, for right now, for me, I don't even know where I got it. Mm-hmm. And it's a fine time to leave me, Lucille, four hungry children in the crops
in the field.
Oh, you too. Okay, so there we are. So for me,
I've seen some sad times, been through some bad times, but this time the hurting won't heal.
You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille. How come you know it?
Because I love that song. I don't know, because it resonates, because I've known it forever. Like you, I don't remember when I guess it was force-fed to me on Top 40 radio decades ago.
Yes, but when? And I have no memory of that. And for some reason, for the last few days, it just won't go away. Now I've made it worse. But here's the thing about that. Yeah. You could define your generation more or less, and perhaps mm-hmm. even now can, mm-hmm. by certain memories that you have in common. They're not just things you learned by heart. They're things that happened in your time, mm-hmm. or they're kind of proverbs that everybody said to you, or the very boring things that said to you, or things that irritated you, or things that you laughed at. But you have that memory in common with your own age group pretty much. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that until now, pretty much until now, whether or not they taught you or insisted that you memorize rotten poems in school or wonderful poems in school, memory was cross-generational. That is, we might have music that we preferred to the music that our parents might, or it mm-hmm. might not matter, but there was overlap. There was a lot of overlap.
Yes,
of
there
memory.
Was. Yes, there was.
So, in a way, I don't know why I know Mother Goose rhymes. I'm not even sure anymore why we learned them. I certainly didn't understand them. I still don't understand them, really, but we know them.
They're fun to read aloud to a very, very young child. They're mesmerizing
somehow.
Yes, why
is that? Chalk hand understand them either, right? I mean, there was an old woman who lived in a shoe. It's kind of fun.
But they're hearing language. They're hearing repetition. They're probably looking at some funny photo pictures, illustration at the same time.
Right. And they're hearing rhyme. And they're hearing a certain meter of speech and cadences and stuff. And so I wondered if there's some way to figure out without doing it on the internet. Because now, of course, even for someone as old as I, it's quite natural when I don't remember something to look it up on the internet.
Sure.
Not even in the encyclopedia. I can be as vague as I want
about it.
And so a lot of memory is – a lot of the need for memory is eliminated for me, even though I'm still not a computer person. But I wondered for somebody who's brought up right now whether it is still true that we have memories in common. For instance, we all need to know the alphabet. Even now, they need to know the alphabet. But taking something that was memory that was no fun at all, the multiplication table, so far as I knew, was no fun for anybody. But we learned it. But that's about the only – do they still learn multiplication tables?
I'm not so sure that they always do even. But I wonder about your reference to cross-generational memory and shared language across generation. I know – everyone must share language with their parents. I remember sharing a lot of language with my grandparents as well, understanding lots and lots of phrases whose roots clearly were far predated my existence. Do you think that's lessening now? Are we shedding?
I don't know, but that's very much the point. It's very much the point, isn't it? Because it's not uncommon in America, since my parents were immigrants. We spoke a different language at home, though it was kind of odd in our case. But we spoke German at home and then English in the world at large. But it was quite common in the American experience to be an immigrant, to be hurled into the school.
Yes.
And to learn English because you were hurled into the school. The minute there began to be the notion of English as a second language and a special teacher, I think it was a disaster, just a disaster, because it's very good for every child to – otherwise, well, all right, but that's not really what we're talking about. But what I wondered is if there's a cutoff in memory, if you don't, then the narrative of a certain kind of culture has come to an end. And I think it's possible, but it's also possible that it hasn't. But I think there are many signs that the narrative of the American culture I knew and the culture of Western civilization, insofar as I knew it, may be coming to an end. So that's it's a very slim point.
I would beg to differ. It hardly seems a slim point. American culture as you knew it, civilization as you've known it, coming to an end. It seems like
I meant to say I left off the last book because I couldn't figure out how to articulate it. I still can't. But it's a very slim point to balance a thought like that on. I mean, there are other reasons, I think, and I never thought this before, and I used to rather despise people who thought anything like it, that there was a crucial, maybe end times moment upon them. And now I'm not so sure there isn't an end times moment upon us. And what I meant was so slim was it would be very slim to base
hinge it all on Mother Goose's absence.
Mother Goose, yes. I wouldn't want to hinge it on Mother Goose. But there's certainly, it seems to be, signs everywhere. And very, very few signs to the contrary. And insofar as there are signs to the contrary, they have to do with young people I've met who are just absolutely wonderful. So, I mean, there's a generation that I suppose, unless I've been exceptionally lucky and the people that I've met can deal with what we've given them, if anyone can.
I mean, you've followed this slender thread, if it is that, sort of to the heart of what I wanted to come to you on and then put it in the most stark terms, end times of any kind. That's very dramatic, some kind of cultural break, maybe a break in shared language across generation is one piece of background to that. But when you look out, what's the evidence for anything of the sort of an end times dynamic going on culturally?
Well, let's see. Of course, our lifetime seems to us very long because it's all we've got.
Yeah.
But in the scheme of things, it's very short, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it could be that these, in retrospect, will seem to be wonderful times. But I think these are, by these, I mean perhaps beginning beginning with the beginning of the George W. Bush administration and clear through the Obama administration. Don't see that much difference. We have no statesman. We have no president. We have no policy. Insofar as we do have a policy, it's not – I mean, just speaking politically, it's ghastly in my view. We have sometimes – well, just to start somewhere, you know, do you remember Pat Moynihan?
Of course. Very, very well.
Okay. So there was Pat Moynihan, and it seemed – I mean, he was
New York senator, super articulate, wise observer of many things, and able to cross political boundaries pretty well very often, too.
Very often, and much punished for it because people didn't sort of like it. And then he was a Harvard professor as well. And also such a nice man, such a really kind man, but saw things. And some of them seemed to me right then. Some of them seemed to me exaggerated then. I don't think anything seemed to me quite wrong then. But one of the things he saw, which I think – I mean, it sounds minor, but I think it's enormous. He foresaw how dangerous in every sense the American civil – the American secret services are, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI for that matter. And, of course, I grew up in a generation believing they were wonderful and that they were always solving things and doing things. And then he came forward and he said, just about the CIA, he said, now look, you know, since they've been founded, they have never been right about anything.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with legendary journalist, critic, occasional novelist, Renata Adler, about American culture and where it's turned, where it's turning, how it's changed in her many years of watching, writing. Her latest collection of nonfiction is After the Tall Timber, out this spring. She's watching everything. You can get an excerpt of the latest at our website, onpointradio.org. One of those she admires, longtime Democratic senator from New York, the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan. You just heard her reference his comments about the culture of secrecy in Washington, saying here it was out of control, unchecked form of government regulation, he told 60 Minutes in 1997.
Government can say, we'll let you know what you can know. The public have the right to know. There are things that require secrecy, but we overdo it so.
1997, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Fast forward 2013, here's Edward Snowden talking about widespread NSA wiretapping in the 2014 Oscar-winning documentary Citizen Four.
The NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends.
We're with Renata Adler at 800-423-8255. Renata Adler, I want to dive on into American culture now, where it stands, but could we back up for a minute to get a beat on you and how your view of the world may have been formed? You mentioned a bit about your family coming to this country. Could you describe when and how? And then the generation that you're part of, sort of after the World War II fighters, before the street fighters of the 60s, and how that may have shaped your worldview.
Well, with myself, I came when I was a year old, so it doesn't count really. It's true that I spoke German to my parents always and was a refugee for whatever that implies. But it's not so very interesting in that, to me anyway, but well, of course, it is in a way. But right now, as you can see, I'm obsessed with this other question, and I think it has to do with the past and with the early pieces in this book. That is, my generation was very lucky. We had every reason to think, and we were. I mean, the war had been run by the right side. We knew which was the right side. The war for us, of course, was World War II.
You were born in 38, so you were a child in the war, and then you could look back on it as you came of age.
Yes, yes. And I could look back on actually the day we won it and so on. But of course, but that isn't it. Then here in this country, the civil rights question in the South, I don't think anyone has explored that. Maybe it's too soon. In a way that understands what an enormous great thing that was to occur within a country. It's just, it was, as it happened, it was this incredible community in the South, the black community in the South, in the churches, not in the churches, brave, peaceful, rather brilliant for a period of years. There was no violence at all. There was nothing. All the violence was on the other side, and the good guys were winning. And I think it's very important and very lucky to have an experience of seeing or reporting on or even being part of the good guys who are winning. And then in Vietnam, that was something different. And we weren't, though we still had some reason to think we might be the good guys. And as it happens, we were in effect losing. And we had no experience of losing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel about Vietnam as many people felt about Vietnam. But
you were there. You reported there.
But it wasn't really reporting there. That was such a bizarre, tragic situation. And, of course, it was a war, really, that President Kennedy began and President Ford brought to an end. And it's hard to know. I mean, the people we blame in memory is President Nixon and, mm-hmm. and President Ford, but that really does seem to me an aberrant piece of history. But to come now to the point, I mean, 9/11, everybody agrees that that was a turning point, but I don't think it was a turning point because it was a tragedy, right? We were for the first time hit like that and lots of our citizens died. I mean, that's a European experience all the time. It just was unique in its dramatic way, mm-hmm. but the Secret Services, that's when it came home how right Pat Moynihan was, because he said they were always wrong about everything, and they were. They had been wrong about the Cold War. They said the Russians, the Soviet Union was catching up to us militarily and culturally and economically just before the Soviet Union collapsed. They were wrong about Iran. That's why the hostages were taken there. And in fact, even in my time, as recently after 9/11, the CIA wanted to reclassify a document in which they assured President Truman that the Chinese would not enter the Korean War. So they're very jealous of their reputation, and they are, in fact, mostly a public relations agency for themselves. But they've become an incredible danger to the country. They didn't foresee 9/11. They didn't analyze it correctly. They don't understand it now. They use it as their paradigm for everything they want to do to anyone for no reason. And then I never thought I'd see the day when high American officials would be advocating torture. I mean, on the one hand, they say that we don't do it. And then they talk about something called rectal feeding, which any small child knows is impossible. But then with their peculiar sense of humor, they said on the lunch tray for these rectal feedings.
This is when prisoners are trying to go on hunger strike.
There wasn't any hunger strike there. Well, it was people. Tom. Mm-hmm. This was in these foreign places CIA was doing its waterboarding and all of that with people who, it turned out, had no information. Although the CIA would never admit it, but that either they had no information or they weren't telling. Torture is not the way to get it. You read those reports, and of course, there's nothing more boring than reading a government report. But you read those reports, and you can't believe it. There they are. They're talking about the lunch tray that they bring for the rectal. I mean, for the enema, for the forced enemy, and they're talking about the lunch tray, and they're putting on it hummus. And I thought I would never believe that anybody in our country, and in this case, it was, I believe, Michael Hayden, who had many important posts in government and in defense, and some interviewer asked him about those things, and he said those were feedings and there were medical needs for them. And then the reporter sort of said, Mr. Hayden or Dr. Hayden or General Hayden or whatever he is said, I'm not a doctor and neither are you.
Ooh.
And I thought, you're putting all our boys in danger, our girls too. I mean, anybody tortures us now, we can no longer say we don't do that. We not only do it, we claim it's something else. Well, and then on top of that, we claim it works.
What's gone wrong there, Renata Adler? What's gone wrong that made that, to whatever small number signed off on it, and maybe in some way there's a collective responsibility that made that possible?
Yeah, and that would be the worst of it. If we're all responsible for it, then that's pretty bad, because it's so hard to see what we can do about it. I don't see what the American people could have done, for example, just to take one example, but vote for President Obama. And there were promises and there was an aura and there was a spirit, and it turned out none of it was true. I mean, none of it was true.
You're that disenchanted, disappointed with the Obama
presidency?
Yes,
I voted for him both times, but it goes beyond disenchantment. It goes it's sort of every day. It's sort of a showbiz, public relations, self-satisfied. And he reminds me almost every day as President W. Bush jumping up and down on the ship and saying, mission accomplished.
Obama reminds you of George W. Bush.
He certainly does. And I would think in history, if there is a history afterwards, there is not. I mean, unless we find a statesman somewhere, at some level, there is not going to be a significant interruption. That's a single 16-year presidency, and I never dreamed I would think that.
In the year 2015, Renata Adler is using the phrase end times to talk about American culture.
I didn't mean to use that, but that mean it.
But it popped out.
There
it was, and it's got a certain specific gravity to it. Renata Adler joins us from New York. Lots of listeners calling in for you, if I may turn to them. Philothea is calling from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Philothea, you're on the air with Renata Adler.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And I'm really grateful to hear about Renata Adler. And in all my years, I've never heard of her and I've never read any of her books, so I'm really anxious to do this. I think we really need philosophy like this to see the larger picture, and I do really resonate with what she's saying. One of the things I wanted to mention was these history books now that are coming out that are trying to tell us how history really happened, and I'm thinking of this one, Lies My Teacher Told Me, but Howard Zinn has written some things. We have a mythology of America that has been perpetuated through the stories about our founding fathers and various different things that happened in history, and now, you know, we're finding out a lot of these things actually weren't true or didn't happen quite that simply and so forth. And yet what does that do when you lose your mythology of your country and it's all kind of undermined and doesn't seem to be true?
Oh, but then I have somehow conveyed an idea I didn't mean to convey, which is that Howard Zinn, for example, is very, very, very far left from where I sit. And I was in the year – no, and I think the mythology of the country was, in fact, the history of the country. I mean, there were lapses, but there was a tradition, and we were and are, I believe – I mean, I believe in American exceptionalism. No, not exceptionalism. It's the wrong word because it leads us astray. But there has never been a country like this one. There has never been a constitution like this one. There has never been – nearly 200 years of the kind of behavior with lapses and with all these things we can call retrospectively anything we like. This was a great and highly moral country, a decent country.
Despite all of its kind of original sins around slavery and Native Americans and the rest?
Yes, well, those were terrible sins, and we've taken them in, and mm-hmm. we, who are not the generation who perpetrated them, are doing the best we can. And the slavery is no longer here, but the countries that we count among our great allies, for example, in the Middle East, still have slavery. And, I mean, it's just completely come undone, I think, only recently. And it's partly because we have no statesman. And I enormously admire Edward Snowden because who could have expected that? There he is. He comes out and he tells things. He tells things that people – I'm sorry. Maybe you have more to ask.
No.
In your question.
I think you're on the heart of it there. But you hear Philothea wrestling with the notion that what you've understood about your country isn't true, and trying to find, well, then what is the narrative?
Well, but I don't think I would say it isn't true. I would say it is no longer true. It is at this moment not true, and I hope it comes true again. And having somebody like Snowden, who after all, enrolled in the military, right? Mm-hmm. And then he comes and he does this thing, and the reaction of the agencies tells you so much, because they like to say, and I must say including the president and the then Attorney General, I believe improperly, but all right. It tells you so much that Snowden was sort of a traitor in that he gave away such important secrets of the techniques of our agency so that now our enemies can use them. Well, if those techniques were so effective, how did they not detect that they had a Snowden in their midst?
Yeah.
It's just finished. It's just And there's no way. How do you get a grip on these problems as a citizen, or if one were a congressman or senator? I don't know either, but I don't see many signs of senators or congressmen. We just don't have statesmen at the moment. The moment produces statesmen.
We're talking with legendary journalist, critic Renata Adler. Caller Paul in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air with Renata Adler. Thanks for calling, Paul.
Yes, hello, Tom. And found your comment about the grand narrative coming to a place in which there's a real juncture here for you. Your
exactly.
formation of the American experience going forward, to me, is juxtaposed against one idea. I mean, I look at the Atlantic and Ta-Nehisi Coates and around mass incarceration, and then what I'm thinking is that what you're describing, especially the American experience from your perspective, strikes me that now there's an assertion of what used to be called the minority perspective. But what in fact it is, seems to me, is that these voices are now gaining greater credibility, greater kind of a role in shaping what we now understand as the grand narrative of America. And I want to bring this notion forward because one of the things you bring up, I think about with the CIA, I'm thinking about COINTELPRO or Daniel Patrick Moynihan's statement on the black family. That was outside of our experience as an African American, looking at and then telling us how our community and how our way of engaging and, of course, moving forward the American project as it is, a continuing project. And when you say there's a juncture, a breaking point, an end time, mm-hmm. it strikes me that, in fact, what it reflects is the emergence of the greater America, in which now the voices of what used to be now the minority, which now we now are calling just simply the grand, diverse America, is now asserting itself and claiming a role in shaping that narrative and bringing forth a more true perspective on what it took to become the America that we are today.
Paul, I'm so glad for that. I've got 2 minutes before a break here. Let me allow Renata to respond. Renata.
Paul, I would say that I, with all respect, disagree. And I have to say that the positions I've taken just now are not positions I held in the past, and I don't think the positions I held in the past were wrong. I think something new has happened, and I think this other narrative that is seeking to replace the old narrative is wrong. It's destructive. It doesn't tell us, I mean, with all due respect, doesn't tell us anything. It's not the true narrative.
But why? I mean, here's Paul saying, look, this is the inclusion of me in voices like mine, and how can that be anything but a fuller
realization? Well, I don't know how you define your voice. What voice do you feel is not represented? Do you feel that black voices are not represented?
Well, he starts there. He starts there, certainly. With the marginalization, I think it's fair to say he's describing of black voices for a long, long time in this country.
Well, I agree they were marginalized for a long time, but not, I believe, in the time you're talking about, including now. I mean, we've had racial difficulties, which I think are largely class difficulties. And then I think the kind of voices that have come forward is the left that we always had, and they don't add anything, in my view, to the conversation. I just think, oh, here they are again. They're saying, this is what we always told you. You killed the Indians that were the Native Americans that were here. We have a black president. We have the black presence a lot of places. I don't see it that way. That's not the true narrative going back. That's the turn the narrative has taken.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with legendary journalist, critic, occasional novelist Renata Adler about American culture and where it's turned, how it's changed in her many years of watching, writing. Her latest collection of nonfiction essays is After the Tall Timber. Her novels Pitch Dark and Speedboat, reissued a couple of years back. Excerpt of After the Tall Timber at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from New York today. Renata Adler, you talked about language being lost between generations. Here's a listener responds online. Arun Blatchley says, regarding shared phrases across generation, I'm 25, the child of baby boomer. I constantly have problems with peers who do not understand the idioms I use, like read them the Riot Act or six of one, half dozen of the other. It's often hilarious since my friends sometimes go years before they ask me what something means.
Wondering why
there would be less of this cross-generational phrase planting and carriage these days than before.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful, because that is very much the kind of thing I mean. And yeah, it happens all the time. I want to say something, which is that in response to Paul still,
saying diversity has enlarged our culture and not hearing you reflect that.
Yes, I don't. I may have misrepresented everything I believe. I think something was – I mean, Moynihan, for example, even the brief description of Moynihan, used the phrase benign neglect with respect to the race problem. And as he used it, it could not have been more innocent, more apt. Okay, people are offended. People – particularly people who don't think very hard and who listen to what other people say and say the same thing. So
he was saying racial minorities were the subject of benign neglect. Others might have said act of racism.
Yeah, no, what he was saying is stop intervening so aggressively in everything. And later, this is almost always forgotten, he managed to bring up and nearly get passed by the Senate a guaranteed annual income. It was to the top of the Senate, was SR1 or whatever they call them, to be passed. And the people who defeated it were because the left is a whole other question, because it's fairly predictable what people who say, well, we've been villains all along and now it's coming out. They always think it's coming out. So they didn't vote for it because it wasn't enough money, the guaranteed. Of course, the Republican right wing didn't
vote for it. And the right, of course, would be against it. Now there's talk about it again with not enough jobs apparently to go around, people thinking about it anyway.
Yeah, but he was thinking about it in this wonderful way where you eliminate the whole bureaucracy devoted to seeing that some people are poor so that they can be paid for tending to the – I mean, it was brilliant. And what defeated it basically was some people are never persuaded that things are getting better and we have to stay with them. And luckily, in my book, it happened a lot that things were getting better. But it also happened quite a lot that people who were disenchanted with the system even then held conventions and so forth. And I did cover those. And I must say I didn't cover them very sympathetically. I was more impressed by the Selma March than, say, a radical convention in Chicago.
We've got a number of people pushing back on your assertion of this continuities, 16-year presidency of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, particularly on the torture front that you raised. Listeners saying, wait a minute, Obama's first act as president was to ban the torture that you're decrying, Renata.
I don't see it and I don't believe it. And I can't help noticing that he refuses to blame anyone. He refused then to blame anyone. No one. I mean, it's almost like the bankers. No one. I mean, it's almost too big to fail on every front, including in our agencies. That is, he says he banned. He wants to ban. It was always banned. It was always against American law. It was always against international law. Didn't keep anybody from practicing it. It turns out that somehow we can't deal with this. And also it's quite frightening because they do retaliate. They do retaliate, these agencies, and the more post 9/11 legislation, because, I mean, what congressman is going to come out and say, well, you know, the armed forces concur and everybody concurs. It's very important that we spy on our own people and come to the wrong conclusions almost always, particularly in the Middle East. I mean, you look at the Middle East and you see what can it be the secret agencies are telling the president that causes us to meddle in everything, lose everything. We talk about not wanting to bomb civilians. Of course we don't want to bomb civilians. If there's something we should have learned in Vietnam is when you have guerrillas, it makes sense. If you have guerrilla warfare, they vanish among the population. So if you're going to bomb them, you can use a B-52, you can use whatever you want. You're going to hit civilians because there are no metropolitan centers like ours. With something like ISIS, if you're bombing ISIS, why are you using a whole missile? ISIS vanishes into the public. And then somebody told him they were the junior varsity of al-Qaeda. That's the quality of information he gets, apparently, and believes, apparently, and then sort of promises to abolish his abuses by.
Dennis, in Omaha, Nebraska, you're on the air with Renata Adler.
Hello, Ms. Renata. And I got a couple things. I still love Obama. And the thing that really
I could be wrong about that. I feel awfully vehement about it. I could be wrong.
Okay. Well, one thing that I felt feel strongly about is that President Obama is not looking for an excuse to start a war. He's not abusing religion to rile people up for action against to start a war. And he may not have been able to close Guantanamo, but I think he gave it a serious try, and everyone knows he gave it a serious try. And
I don't know that.
Okay. Well, yeah,
so
right.
it's. I mean, it's interesting if you know that. I don't dispute it. I just don't know it. But in the Middle East, I cannot imagine a worse administration than this one. And the legacy, since he does worry about his legacy, is almost unspeakable. It's so bad.
What would you point to in that regard? I mean, he.
We were arming the moderates in Syria.
Yeah, well, ineptly.
As if we knew who the moderates were, as if there were any moderates. And only in the last few days, the totally predictable thing has come out that they immediately gave our arms to every – I mean, it's almost impossible. So detailed are the mistakes we make there to find any in particular. In the meantime, and
worse than marching wholesale into Iraq.
I think continuous with marching wholesale into Iraq, but more detailed, more perverse. And then this very strange policy toward Israel, which everybody – we want to be very careful about because some people might be Jewish and so they shouldn't talk about it because that explains their Israeli sympathies and then some people – it's a disaster. There is a democracy. There's a true ally. There real freedom exists. There is thriving in the desert. I don't want to come out Zionist on this. I just want to say our alliances are pretty odd and very, very clear. And the president cannot bring himself to say Islamicist and says it has not – he says Islam is a religion of peace. Well, we can all say anything. It just – we just don't have jihad in most other languages, and we don't even have infidel. So – but I don't want to get into that. It seems to me so detailed. It's everywhere, even in Paris when there was a disaster at Charlie Hebdo, right? Nobody could be pro-gunning down – some people in an office of a magazine of caricature. And our Secretary of State, John Kerry, who was, after all, a credible and wonderful, I think, candidate for president until the Swift Boat veterans. Well, all right, there was John Kerry in Paris, and he could not be bothered to join the march that even European leaders joined, which was Je suis Charlie. You may remember it.
Yeah.
And why? That's a statement by the United States about an act of terrorism that occurred. And it would have been very appropriate, actually, to march along with everybody else saying we just – particularly if you happen to be in Paris already.
Renata Adler longs for statesman. Nick in Dayton, Ohio, you're on.
Hey. Hello. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Renata, you seem to be very knowledgeable in a lot of areas regarding the foreign policy and so on. I've always noticed that it doesn't really matter who's really president. At least in the past 20 years, that we seem to be marching down a path of some global power, so to speak. I don't want to be paranoid or
Nick, I think you're right.
But
I didn't mean to talk so
much. Do you happen to see anything in that area?
I'm sorry, Nick. I couldn't make out what. Where are we marching?
Actually,
you know, it seems to be that there's something behind the government that is controlling, no matter who is in office. And you know, how is that really? Do you see that as really being the case? Or
but what are you talking about, Nick? Are you talking about special interests? Are you talking about moneyed interests? Yeah. Are you talking about I don't know?
Well, it could be anything. You know, there almost seems to be a power that's behind our foreign policy and what we happen to be doing, you know, when it comes to that issue with respect to Bush or Obama or whoever is in office.
I think you're right. I think – and I interrupted you, which made your point less clear. But there does seem to be something that drives us to intervene everywhere in everything. We have no business in most countries. We have no business in most disputes. We have a country. We have our own problems. We need to deal with them. I'm not an isolationist. You're not a paranoid. I noticed you noticed the fact. It's just, what are we doing? Why must we have – for one thing, why must we have a viewpoint on everything and act upon it?
It's a small world these days. Things all interact. You don't take care of Syria. Pretty soon you've got waves of refugees in Europe. I mean, one could come up with lots of answers for – why an interconnected world presents itself, even if it's distant.
You could put it that way, Tom, but if we left them alone, for example, one very notable thing which does come up now and then in the press is that the Saudis, who have plenty of room and plenty of interests there, never from days of Palestine onward, they don't want other people there. They protect their soil. Meanwhile, we, with a sense of responsibility, which is admirable, admit them, but I think we are responsible for the creation of those refugees. I think we announced a certain policy, which we shouldn't have done either, on the president of Syria, that he must go. And as soon as something else came up, we suddenly thought, no, he must not go. So suddenly we find ourselves, because of Sunni questions and Shiite questions, we find ourselves partially allied with these and giving them our arms and so forth. I think if we'd stayed out of there, we wouldn't have this Syrian refugee problem.
Chris in Nashville, you're on with Renata Adler.
Hey, Tom. I've called in a couple of times. Every time I do, I hear so many things while I'm waiting that it kind of distorts what I actually initially wanted to say. But I think the problem culturally is what you alluded to earlier, and it's all the technology, you know, Twitter and texting and Yelp. Whatever, I don't even know all of them. And I think people have their nose in that, watching that, and parroting what they see and read on that, instead of lifting their eyes and getting involved. And I don't mean by, you know, volunteering or doing community work or whatever, but just getting involved with the people around them so they can see what's going on and they can form their own opinion. And then the other problem that goes along with that is they don't want to because they don't want to think. And I think culturally that's the problem. People just don't want to think. They just want to parrot what they've heard. And you know, right in with that, I think that the propagandists take advantage of that and they put little things out. And lo and behold, now we have different things, opinions going through the texting and all that sort of thing.
Chris, we've got it. Our time is short. I appreciate your call. How about it, Renata? The internet age, it came to us as a tool for learning, for sharing, for coordinating, for action. It was imagined and foreseen. Of course, everybody's a critic there now. It's true in many ways. I wonder how you see it as a professional critic.
Well, I don't know that here's what I think. I'm very surprised. I mean, what I've been saying, it comes as a complete surprise to me. I mean, this is not the way I usually am. I was a moderate Republican when I was writing The Net. I think this is good, all these people talking on The Net, but mm-hmm. I don't think it has much to do with criticism. And what happens is there we have The Net, and we have it in its phase when it's talking to us. But I think very soon we will have the phase when it's spying on us. And meanwhile, I don't see how, except as you say, getting to know our neighbor and so forth, we all have professions. We don't have time to go to all these places all over the world and see what's really going on there. And I noticed after 9/11, for example, almost no reporters, where it seemed to me there really was a 9/11 story, they didn't go. They had thoughts. They had sources in Washington, highly placed sources who told them this and that. We know more about 9/11 than we did on 9/10, except that people are dead. And I don't even think we know who's responsible for it. And by that, I don't mean anything paranoid like we're responsible for it. I just mean our agencies are just not up to and not interested in solving problems. And when they fail, they always say the same thing. Well, what do you expect? We don't have enough money and we don't have enough power. And so more power is legislated to them and more money is given to them. But I think that's the most statement. What kind of statement could we ask for stronger than 9/11 than that the agencies don't work and we have no way? How can we go? What can we do? What can we do?
Where do you look for hope, Renata Adler? Where do you look for light?
I look for light, I guess, in instances of the past when it really becomes serious, statesmen somehow emerge and people act with good sense and courage, though by no means everywhere and no means always, but that's what saved us every time. And Snowden seems to me so extraordinary. I mean, I don't propose Snowden for public office or anything, but he's such a remarkable exception. He's made no mistakes so far. I wouldn't care what came out about him. He's done something, I think, unprecedented, as far as I know, in history, is to come out and say, look, I can't make these judgments here, but here's what I know. And I'm not telling you the part that I think would endanger our country. So when people say, well, he's endangering our own people, there's no sign of that.
Most lately, what I've seen emerge is Donald Trump.
Yes, well, I just don't know what to say.
We have stumped Renata Adler. Her latest collection of nonfiction is After the Tall Timber. She joins us today from New York City. Renata Adler, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.